Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Bold, Beautiful, Borderline podcast. It's Sarah, and for the first time in a very, very long time, Lori is here recording with me with a guest.
Woo!
It's very exciting, and I just can't wait to hear her perspective in this conversation, too, because this is a conversation I have personally been waiting for. I needed this in my life, and it's come at the perfect time, and we're going to talk about that. But before I introduce Melissa and Melissa's life, we have a couple of Patreon folks to thank. So we are thanking today Laura, Katie, Micah, Christina, Henry, Danielle, and Stacy. Y'all are amazing. We're so grateful for the support that you give us through Patreon. It allows us to keep doing what we're doing. So thank you so much. Okay, Melissa, introduce yourself. What is your pronoun and what are you here to talk with us about?
Hello. So yes, my name is Melissa. My pronouns, she, her, hers. And I'm super excited to be doing this with you guys. It was pretty great finding your guys' podcast. And today, you know, I just want to talk about my experience with borderline and my diagnosis and everything. And then having that diagnosis and also being a therapist, you know, there's a lot of ups and downs with that, those two almost like opposing sides, I feel at times. But yeah, so super excited to answer some questions and just tell about my story.
Yes, I'm so excited. So can I just tell you a little bit about why this is like, so I don't believe in God, but the only thing I can think about is like a God moment. Do you know like what I mean? That like spiritual universe moment, because I have been working through this huge wound in therapy of feeling like I have two different lives. Like I have my life where I'm really open about my mental illness and my advocacy work. And that is like so values-based for me and important. And then I have my work life where a big part of this wound is like a huge scarcity complex and trauma around money, right? And so like my employment is what allows me to live. And I have this whole thing about if anybody ever found out about my borderline diagnosis, then I would lose my job and maybe they would terminate my license because of the stigma. And if I lose my license, then I won't be able to pay for my house. And if I can't pay for my house, my dad will never love me. And if my dad never loves me, like if I can't pay for my house and I have to like file for bankruptcy, then that will be like the reason that everybody will be okay with me dying. Like I have this, can you see how fucking insane that is? That is the most borderline thing ever. And so
Sarah, did you keep that in the episode? Because we talked about this, the episode that came out yesterday. Did you keep that or did you cut it? Because I'm curious.
I closed at the end of your story.
Okay.
And didn't go into mine because it would have been like an hour and a half long.
Yeah. I wonder if we post that to Patreon if you're comfortable, because that was really powerful, I think. And it was,
I'm going to take it live.
Oh, okay, cool. Even better.
I don't know. We'll see. But yeah, so Lori and I talked about this recently, but this has been something I've been working through a lot in therapy because of constantly being in fear of what if the people I work with, and I'm on a 1099 and I'm paneled with insurances. Like my wise mind tells me it's not going to happen, but emotion mind and fear mind is like, you aren't allowed to be a therapist and have borderline personality disorder. And there's this feeling of constantly being in disguise or whatever. And so my therapist was saying, you really should think about kind of like coming out to at least one person in your field. And then all of a sudden, Melissa, you popped up in my DMs. And at the same time, I am training to Oregon Health Sciences University about borderline in 2 weeks. Ooh, and so I'm in the process of making this decision. Do I come out in that presentation or not? So I didn't want to make this about me, but of course I always make it about me. And I just want to say I'm like so grateful that you're here because this conversation feels very important to me.
Oh, thank you. And I'm super excited to like hear about, you know, what you're going through in regards to like this presentation and just like being your true authentic self. So that's really cool that we got to connect.
Yeah, I'm so stoked. Okay, tell us about you. What was little Melissa's life like? Where do you come from? How did you get here?
Yeah, so I grew up in California, still there, or here, whatever you want to call it. And I had a pretty, what I thought to be normal childhood. Definitely, you know, the live in a traditional family, married parents, went to school, had a little brother. Just kind of the average American family, I guess. And then I did sports my whole life. So I started sports, I think, I was like two or three when I joined the swim team. And, you know, looking back and like hearing stories, and now, you know, being a therapist, it's definitely a lot of pressure was put on me at a very young age. So, you know, as I got older, I still thought everything was, quote, like fine. Long story short, I chose basketball to play probably around, I think fifth grade is when I decided that's going to be my focus. And it was awesome. Loved it. Loved going to camps and the tournaments where the college coaches were watching, all that. But I never had that emotional care to my parents. Very, like, if I played well, I got congratulated. If I played poorly, it was like the world's ending and I better, like, quit. You know, my parents or my dad one time said, you know, you should just turn in your shoes and jersey. You're not doing it right. And I'm like, sophomore in high school, like my whole life was basketball. So I didn't even know what that meant. Like turn in your shoes and jersey. Like it was just really hard to hear. And then also looking back, it's just like the connections I was trying to make with my classmates and peers. It was like, no one understood me. I was always, I guess, like an attention seeker, even back like in elementary school. I would do things to get attention and to be like able to talk with people. And I wouldn't make things up, but I would definitely like try things that were, I guess, dangerous, you could say, growing up. And dangerous in the sense, like, I just didn't know that I could be hurt. I like emotionally. And I would just do things that I was like, oh yeah, that sounds like a good idea. And then in high school, yeah, the same thing, just kind of back and forth between trying to make friends, trying to pursue basketball, and nothing felt right. And then when I found out I wasn't going to play Division I basketball, it was like my worth went away. Any worth I thought I had, any like sympathy, empathy from my parents, it was just gone. I did play Division III basketball for a little bit, but it still didn't feel like enough. And looking back, I was noticing that my attention seeking behaviors really got in the way of how I was treated on the team. And I was getting bullied. I never thought I was bullied until I look back and I'm like, oh yeah, that wasn't very kind.
But how old were you at this point?
What?
Sorry. How old were you at this point?
17. I graduated high school at 17. And then my freshman year of college, I was 17 and 18.
Gotcha. Okay. Sorry. I'm Canadian and I get confused about how your guys' school system works.
Oh, my bad.
Yeah, no, it's okay.
Yeah. And I'm kind of jumping all over the place. I know. But yeah, so freshman year of college, played some basketball, was getting bullied. It was just not fun at all. And I remember that summer after freshman year, I told my parents I wasn't going to play anymore. And that was probably one of the hardest conversations I ever had. They did not take it well. They basically said, well, if you're not going to play ball there, you have to transfer schools. We're not paying for you to go to school there. It's too expensive and you won't like it there. Just like basically telling me what I needed. And I thought that's what I needed. I thought I had to listen to my parents and do everything they said. Thankfully, I was able to stay at my school. Just to get out as fast as possible, because I really did not like being away from home because I was so codependent on my parents. And so I ended up joining a sorority and, you know, had some friends, still got bullied for attention seeking. And then my, I think it was end of sophomore year of college. So I was like 18, 19. I went to New York, and that was the first time I spent time with my family, well, my mom on a vacation that wasn't basketball related, and she commented on my weight. And so from then on, it was just really bad eating disorders and depression, anxiety, self-harm, all that. And it came to a point where I was getting help for it my senior year, but also I didn't give a shit. I was just like, I'm going to get out of college as soon as possible, go home, and then life will miraculously get better. So I was told, like, maybe you should step out of college and go get some help. I remember, like, the dean or whoever at my school was, like, checking on me because someone called them about my safety. It was just all over the place. And so then I went home after college, started treatment in an eating disorder program, and that's actually where I got diagnosed with borderline. I ended up in the hospital for mental health reasons. And when I came back to the EDIOP program, they were like, so you have borderline. And then they explained what it was. And I was devastated. I was like, I always knew I had a problem, but why is it called this? Like, this is just a stigma, and everyone just thinks I'm stupid and shouldn't be alive and things like that. And I started working in mental health then, and things just got worse.
No, you're totally fine. You're telling your story beautifully. It's very linear, but I don't want to forget for us to go back and talk about the importance of some of these childhood experiences, particularly in sporting. I feel super passionate about the infighting and in bullying and in emotional abuse that happens in teams, particularly in girls' sports.
For sure.
I had a very similar experience to you. Older sister, younger brother. Both my parents played college baseball and softball. And I was on that same trajectory track, right? Like 18U gold. We went to nationals. Mm-hmm. We took state. I lettered my freshman year.
Yeah.
And I very much felt like my worth was dependent on how I played, in particular towards my father. And so that was like a tool that I could use to feel connection or love with him. And it sounds like the same is happening to you. But as I got older, particularly in high school softball, because I was a freshman on the varsity team, these older girls were like so cruel, right? Like cruel. And I remember I could not physically like grip a ball because I started to have such severe panic and anxiety, and I like couldn't throw because of that.
Yeah.
And the story that you're telling sounds very similar of like, I couldn't figure out how to fit in. So you do the attention seeking thing, and then they're like, she's fucking crazy and we don't want to be around her. And, you know, all of those things, it's devastating. And it is so isolating. And because our culture is to celebrate children who are strong in sporting, we forget to take care of them emotionally. We just force them to work and work and work. And we don't care what other kids are doing to them. My little brother came out at 14 and he was the only gay kid in our city. Right. And thank God my brother's 6'4". None of those kids were going to hurt him, but he would go on tournaments and he would talk to the coach and ask the coach to put him in his own room because he was so afraid of the way his peers would respond to him being gay. And my brother wouldn't shower for like 4 days at these tournaments because he was afraid to be in the bathroom unclothed and have these guys say or do something to him. So the fear that kids experience and that you experience is profound, right? And you're talking about lifelong bullying, and we see the result of it.
I never thought I was bullied or had trauma. And as years have gone on, and I've, you know, talked to many therapists regarding my mental health, it's very clear that emotional trauma is real trauma, and the judgments, the words that have been said to me from my parents and peers. Yeah, it's definitely overwhelming, heartbreaking, and like scary. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know how I got through. I mean, probably like 25 years of my life. I'm 31 now. So,
are you an addict?
Addict? No.
Oh, I don't know how you got through either.
The look of disappointment on Sarah's face in that moment was quite hilarious, actually.
I have had struggles with drinking to cope, and tried out AA. The more I have learned about coping skills and emotion regulation, I have found that drinking just isn't as appealing to me because it doesn't get my needs met. Still have other vices, but that one thankfully has been able to be kind of, I took it very seriously because I knew it was impacting my work, my day-to-day life.
Mm-hmm. I'm just saying you can always try a dive bar and an old man to fuck, you know, and that instant dopamine of like getting railed in the back of a car and just hoping it doesn't roll down a Portland side road, you know?
Ladies and gentlemen, life advice from Sarah.
Stumble home and eat your tacos with your hands. Anyways, I digress.
Okay, I have a question about the sorority thing. So yeah. In Canada, sororities aren't really a thing. Like, they technically exist, but like very rarely. Uh-huh. And it's not like anywhere near like it is in the States. So I've never been in one or around them. But given your eating disorder kind of started getting triggered early in your university days, I'm curious, did the sorority help or hinder that? I mean, I guess you could look at help or hinder in either way, but did it make it worse?
I was going to say, well, how are we going to look at this?
Totally. Did it make it worse, or were they supportive in the sense of like helping you get through your eating disorder?
I didn't really connect with many people in my sorority, just because I was like the odd one, I guess. Mm-hmm. And I don't even know if they knew I had an eating disorder. A couple of them did, probably because I hung out with a couple of them. But I would say it definitely made things worse. Always comparing to the other girls and what they looked like, because I joined the, I don't even know how to describe it, the girly girl sorority in college, mainly because for some reason, which I'm guessing is because no one liked me, I did not get into the athlete one. So it was very interesting. And as I, you know, was in the sorority throughout the years until graduation, I noticed I was having more behaviors like them. In a way, like really caring about my appearance, physical appearance mainly, and just trying to be like the smallest or the most sick. Well, that was a big thing for me. And just kind of like trying to fit in anywhere I could. And I just didn't. So I used my eating disorder and manipulation, attention seeking to like really just live. Anytime something went bad or wrong, like I always knew I could self-harm or engage in eating disorder behavior, and it would protect me in a way from the intense emotions that I hated feeling.
And it sounds like your sense of potentially the sense of self-disturbance or whatever, pretty good example of feeling like you're spending all of this time with a group of people and then you're kind of becoming that group of people. And I know I do that. I'm sure, like, I assume Sarah does that too. And like the sorority is just like a very insular place to do that. Right. Yeah. Because you're literally living with these people. Am I right? Mm-hmm.
I lived in the house for a year, and then usually like as a sophomore or second year, I don't know what you call it in Canada, but
second year. Thank you for clarifying. Yeah.
But I lived in the house that my second year.
Gotcha. Yeah. But that's a lot of time spent with people. And
that what is my literal nightmare?
Being in a sorority?
living with other people and other girls and constantly have people coming in and out and talking. And did you take my flat iron? I swear you took my flat, you know, just like, like the thought of that, the emotions that brings up for me for younger you is so overwhelming. I don't know if your experience was good or bad, but it's overwhelming to me.
Yeah. It was, I wouldn't say it was like horrible, but it wasn't fun. I was miserable. I would try to get out of events all the time. I would make something up or just like run out the door and just not return until the next day or whatever. So that was a lot.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot. What were you studying in school?
Psychology.
Okay, so did you know about borderline when you got diagnosed?
Are you tired of toxic people on the internet?
Yes.
I'm Reagan.
And I'm Chesno.
And we are the hosts of the Mr. Pick Me and the Man Hater podcast. These nicknames were lovingly given to us by a troll on the internet, even though I don't hate men, and Chesco's already been picked.
Together, we discuss some of the absolutely worst people on the internet and laugh along the way, and she'll try not to cry.
So if you want to laugh with us...
or cry.
Then check out the Mr. Pick Me and Manhater podcast. Bye.
Bye.
Kind of, not really. I heard the word, and I knew there was a stigma against it. My school and college didn't really have anything about mental health. I felt like my classes were rat lab and psychology statistics, whatever that was called. Nothing. We had one. It was called abnormal psych. So basically all the, you know, the mental illnesses, I guess they're abnormal. So,
good point.
And I had the worst teacher. She was my supervisor, who actually told me one day after class, or I don't know when, that I should not go to grad school because I would not make it into grad school or as a therapist. And I was like,
I heard that too.
Yeah, you're probably right. Yeah. It's a horrible feeling.
Yeah.
And,
totally abusive. Yeah.
Sorry.
That's just totally abusive. I have to say,
and wrong.
I don't know if this is true in Canada, Lori, but abnormal psych in the States has such a weird bubble around it. Everybody knows, if you have a psych degree, abnormal psych is like the place you go and every student walks out having self-diagnosed.
Oh, 100%.
With like all of these things. And it's just like such a weird class.
They say that in the first day, like, do not self-diagnose. You're going to read this and think you have every single one of these issues, blah, blah, blah. But like, it's really funny that you say that, Melissa, around like, yeah, I have a psych degree, but we didn't talk about mental health much. Because I mean, it's been a long time, I think for all of us, probably a long time since we did our psych degrees. Yeah. But you're right. Like, it's a lot of like cognition, perception, stats, psychopharmacology, like all that stuff, biopsych. So you have to really like seek out the abnormal psych classes. And now that I think about it, like, maybe there were two in my program. Like, there aren't very many. Yeah.
Well, and so, to be honest with you, like, those classes really aren't important. Like, they make abnormal psych out to be this like very important kind of thing. Learning to diagnose isn't hard. Like, you can learn to diagnose because there's all of these tools out there to essentially like lead you to the right place.
Yeah, but what's like,
but what's like super important that is never done in college, not my psych degree 13 years ago or graduate school, which is where we should be teaching this, is the application of this stuff.
Yeah.
Nobody leaves college having any idea how to do therapy, which
you can't in a social work program. Huh? If you have an undergrad, you can't be doing therapy anyways, right? So they probably...
Yeah, correct.
Like, so you have to go to grad school, but it would still be helpful to learn about.
Yeah, for sure. Well, because with a bachelor's degree in psych, you can do kind of like skills training and teaching and case coordination, which is helpful to like reinforce the work being done in individual therapy. But I digress. Yeah. It's like the application, the assessment process, all of that stuff, none of it is really done.
Mm-hmm. And it's all electives, too. For us, at least.
Yeah, in my grad degree, well, the undergrad is like not even really important when you're talking about learning to be a therapist. But like in my graduate degree, we had one class where you learn where you were required to take to learn to be providing therapy in individual or group programs. And I got
in grad school. Holy shit, that's crazy.
Yeah, I got a master's in social work, so I can't speak to what a master's in like marriage and family counseling program would be, but not enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm an MFT. We had application skills teaching.
Sorry, MFT, really, marriage and family?
Counseling? Oh, yeah, marriage and family therapy. Thanks. I really actually loved grad school, and I thought it was super helpful. I did work in mental health before that. I thought it would be a great idea to work in a psych hospital. Super fucking triggering. And I ended up in the psych hospital, a different one, many times during my time working there. That was the first time I really heard that borderline was such a bad, negative thing. All my coworkers were like, yeah, all of them were like, oh, this person's borderline. They're just going to attention seek, or give them the cocktail, like a bunch of shots, because they're just going to yell the whole time, or we got to restrain that person because they're crazy. And I'm just like, wow, like the stigma is real. And these are people that are professionals. Like I was like 22, so I was obviously still learning, but these people were like 30s, 40s, licensed even. And I'm like, okay, this is interesting. It was very different to hear both perspectives, a client perspective and then a so-called professional's perspective. And I think that's why I really was excited for grad school, because I knew I didn't want to treat patients like shit. I knew I didn't want to hear them say I have borderline and like get scared of them, because I don't know. I don't think I'm scary. I think I have trauma and emotional dysregulation, and that leads to scary shit, but not like I'm out to do anything that is, I don't know, maladaptive. Like it's just kind of what happened over the years.
Yeah, totally. When were you diagnosed? What year or age?
I was 2014 or 15.
So you were already working at the psych hospital.
That's where I don't remember. I don't remember. Okay. All good. I don't remember if I was working at a preschool, because I couldn't hold down any job, and I had been volunteering there forever. Like I would literally fall asleep during nap time with the kids. Luckily I wasn't a teacher. I was just an extra help, but there was a time where they're like, Miss Melissa, would you like they sleep on these little pad things. They're like, would you like me to get you one? And I'm like, oh my gosh, this is embarrassing. They literally know I can't stay awake.
But also, yes, if you don't mind, that'd be great.
I was like, yeah, please. So yeah, I think I worked at the preschool, and then I went to treatment, and then I got kicked out of treatment, went back to treatment, and then I thought I was cured. So I applied for a psych hospital job and was totally like, oh yeah, they asked about, I don't even know. They're like, what's your personal experience with mental health? And I was like, well, I had an eating disorder growing up, and like, it was really hard. And I learned about self-compassion and self-love and like emotions, coping skills. And they loved it, which is funny because I was having behaviors like that same day that I interviewed, and definitely not in the past. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's kind of the thing about being at any level, case coordinator, case manager, direct care, therapist, fucking psychiatrist, doesn't really matter what kind of work you're doing. When you have a mental illness, the mental illness is going to be there even while you're working. Right. And I go into sessions 15 minutes after a strong emotion dysregulation episode. Right. Yeah. That is just the reality of this work. You figure out how to get it together and get back in session. You do the work that you're teaching people, right? And you are like a living example of it. But I think outsiders would be shocked to watch the stuff that happens in between periods of work as people with mental illness. And the same is probably true of Lori. Lori's probably having like a ginormous panic attack, sitting on the floor, crying profusely, and then is in a meeting an hour later, because that's just what you do.
Mm-hmm. I've definitely had a lot of those days. Yeah. It's crazy to think, like, at least for me, I look at my therapists and I'm like, oh, wow, you guys are so normal. Like, you got your shit together and you have like a successful career, family, animals, whatever it is. And then I'm like thinking like, oh, wow, I have none of that. I'm just a loser and can't get my shit together because I have borderline and I still have behaviors. And then I'm like, wait, I'm a therapist. I went to grad school and passed the test and everything. I have a family. Well, dogs and cat. Well, that's another part of my story. I'm gay now, I guess you can say. I was married to a man and that didn't go over well. So that's another like huge part of kind of my borderline stuff. But yeah, I have a family. I have a wonderful wife. She's amazing. She's actually in school for social work right now. And so it's just, I don't know, life's pretty good. And there's still like a lot of hardships, but like, I shouldn't say I'm a failure because I have borderline, but it's where my thoughts go.
Well, that's how it feels, right? Like, and so yeah. I want to talk about that because that is one of the things that is very hard and that I talk about in therapy, is like in therapy with my provider, not what I do with people.
Yeah.
I fucking know I'm a weird therapist. I know that my clients come to me and they will leave someday and look back on that therapy experience and be like, she was kind of weird. Like, I'm aware of that because I have to tell people when I start therapy with them, listen, I'm a queer millennial with ADHD. Like, it's important that you know that because sometimes I fidget. Sometimes I have to stand up. If I ever interrupt you, it's not because I don't care. It's because like of my ADHD and stuff. I don't tell them about my borderline, but I know that the way that I speak to my borderline clients and the way that I speak about their diagnosis is very different than the way that other people have spoken to them. And in the back of my head is always, do they know? Do other people know? When I'm in a meeting, are people thinking I'm weird? Because I say things that are different. When you have borderline, you say things that are different and you say things impulsively and you will say like, I don't agree with that, you know? Yeah. And like, I've had clients where I've said, listen, I kind of think that's bullshit. And I've talked that specific incident through with my therapist and come to a really good place with it where like, and it wasn't an issue with the client, but I felt so much shame that I said, I think that's bullshit.
People make fun of me at work all the time for the stuff that I say. And will say like, Lori, you can't say any of those things in this meeting. And I'm like,
I have said that to Lori about an email she's written. And I was like, Lori, you can't say that.
But
and
it's like,
she's felt I'm the going same about me.
Yeah. And like, but I also, I say it most of the time. And then the funny thing is the same people that make fun of me for like, being too impulsive or saying too much or being too open or whatever, are then like, wow, you're so good at your job. You get so much done. And I'm like, yeah, because I don't dick around with the bullshit.
Yeah.
I get straight to the point. And I'm not a clinician, for the record. I'm an administrative manager kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But I don't mess around with the bullshit. I don't have time to like kind of go around the conversation and like take five meetings to get to a point. Like if there's a point, we're gonna get to it now and then we're gonna do the thing. And that's why I'm effective, right? So it's taking that, like, you don't fit within this box that professionals are supposed to have. And then being like, well, screw the box. I don't want to fit in the box. The box is holding everybody back. And here I am outside of the box. Yeah. And I'm happy about it.
And that box is so traumatic because I can probably speak for all three of us. Our parents held it and hold it so strongly. My parents are boomers. My dad owns a business. My mom's a principal. They look what professionalism is supposed to look like. And here I am. And sometimes I roll out of bed 10 minutes before I do therapy with people, because that's just what you have to do sometimes. And I know I don't look like that. And so I'm interested to know your experience. Like, does having borderline ever influence your fears about yourself as a provider?
Oh my gosh, yeah. That imposter syndrome, like literally every client I've ever worked with. I would say especially with people that are borderline, which is weird. I would feel like I would be like more like chill and relaxed because like I know what they're talking about when they say like the all or nothing statements. Not exactly their experience, of course, but like I get nervous that like I'm going to say something and they're going to think like, oh, this bitch doesn't know what she's talking about. And then it's like, well, I don't want to say, well, I have borderline. So, but I'll say like I have depression or anxiety or yeah, I've taken meds or take meds. But when it comes to borderline, no way. So definitely just like, I feel like I walk on eggshells with myself when I'm treating clients at times, depending on what they talk about, because I'm so scared I'm going to like do emotional harm, even though I know what works for me most is having that connection with a therapist. So, and I've been told by clients, like, I just really like the vibe in here, or that we played games or talked about the hard stuff and the fun stuff. So, but I definitely have the thought of like, I don't deserve to be in this role.
Mm-hmm.
Of a therapist.
I get a lot of that verbal validation from clients too, and we see good outcomes. When I know that clients aren't a good fit for me, we have that conversation, right? Because like I'm a really good fit for a specific kind of client. Mm-hmm. And my psychiatrist has asked me when I've talked to her about this fear, we talk about it a lot less obviously because it's psychiatry and not therapy, but she's like, Oh, is it a part of your practice to self-disclose? She just fucking said that like it's not a big deal. And I was like, No, Megan, it's not. And she was like, oh. And I'm thinking to myself, is that a thing? You know, because she was saying to me, you should get in this Facebook group or whatever for therapists. And she was saying like, mm-hmm. you can build your entire practice around supporting people with borderline because you know how to do it. I didn't even think that there's a world in which we can be out publicly and be a therapist with borderline. And so what are your thoughts about that? Have you ever self-disclosed to anybody? Because I've only self-disclosed to one client.
I have never self-disclosed to a client about my borderline. People like coworkers have known, whether I was friends with them, like when I first got diagnosed or.
One of the things that I struggle with, and I'm interested to get your perspective as an outsider, because this is a big part of my fear. Mm-hmm. I could just lie about my borderline or not lie. I could hide my borderline for the rest of my life and nobody would find out at work and I would have a lot less anxiety. But there's fucking 1,000 hours of me talking about getting railed in the back of a car after a binging drinking episode and my borderline diagnosis. So if somebody really wanted to find out, they would find out. Yeah. And that's one of my things, is like this severe fear that someone will find Lori and I's work. And it's not hard. All a client would have to do is search borderline personality disorder podcast.
Right.
We're the first that pops up. So what are your
number thoughts one BPD about podcast on the list, baby?
What are your thoughts about that fear that I have as a person working in therapy with borderline?
Yeah, I definitely, I'm not like public really about my borderline, like even with family. I mean, like my parents know, they don't believe I have it, which is ironic. And my wife knows, and then my ex-husband. But like, I fear more like if I say something about borderline and then I'm like, oh shit, yeah, that like it, about myself. I don't fear someone's going to find out unless I say something, but I definitely fear they're going to pick up on it. Like, my, I don't know, like how I word things or what I've said or what I do or have done in the past. And I don't want to get questioned like, oh, do you have borderline or, oh, why did you do this? So I definitely have that fear of like uncertainty with it. Yeah.
I have spent many nights just lying awake with profound fear. And for me, all of this really is rooted in that like deep trauma associated with money. All I think about is money constantly and like compare myself to other people because of money and get angry about what other people have financially that I don't have. And I have like a lot of trauma around that and losing my career. Do you ever worry about losing your career?
Oh, 100%. The fear of losing my career. Not so much in regards to like saying something to a client that was not helpful, but more just like if I decompensate more than I already have and then like just don't show up for work or like self-sabotage, basically.
Got it. Yeah, my fear is like the opposite of yours in that it's all systemic because I have this weird trust in myself that no matter how deep off the rails I get, I will just be able to pick up and show up for an appointment, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
It's not healthy. I don't know how I can do that. I don't know if my career is like a form of dissociation. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know. Speaking of dissociation, I just kind of blanked. What is your fear again? People noticing you Yeah.
Yeah. People noticing or just like me self-sabotaging and me noticing, but not do anything about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Does it hurt your feelings that I said that, that my fear isn't related to that?
Oh gosh, no.
Okay.
I, you know, like we have borderline, but like, all our experiences are different. Like we could connect with each other on a level of like, oh, I totally get what that means. But I think everyone has their own story. And if we agree or disagree with something, like that's totally valid.
Yeah. What are your thoughts about the future of your work in therapy? Cause I have a, and there's going to come a time when it's like, you know what? I don't really feel like talking about rape 25 times this week.
Yeah. Yeah.
What are your, like, I know for me, I have a long-term goal of building a practice that I can do one-on-one supervision and then be providing the administrative stuff for clinicians to do the work. So like, that's a goal of mine where I'm still connected to the field, but not doing individual kind of work with clients, more doing coaching and teaching. And I also want to, find some like teaching jobs at a local community college or something. But I have this dream of fucking going and learning how to do like, permanent makeup, like professional makeup tattooing and like going to esthetician school and like probably like once a month, I'm up in the middle of the night researching all the local places I could learn to do that. And then being like, I can't afford it. I'm never going to do that. I'll never make money. Nobody will ever like think I'm successful. So I can't do that. But what are your thoughts about the future and like your mental health and how to maintain your employment?
Yeah. So I love where I'm at right now with my career. I work under a therapist. And I've been licensed for a little over 2 years. So I actually just took the training to be a supervisor. So I'm going to like kind of stay with where I'm at. And then kind of whenever she has more therapists that she wants to take on to get hours, then I'll kind of start to train some of them and just kind of like help them see like their positive attributes for being a therapist. And so similar to like what you were saying, like the coaching aspect and like supervision aspect, I definitely do not want to run a business that gives me too much anxiety. But I definitely want to keep helping people in really any capacity. And I agree. I think there's going to be a time where I'm not so much wanting to sit with clients day to day for ever. But for right now, I definitely like where I'm at and want to keep spreading the word of like mental health support and break the stigmas and let people know, like, regardless of what path we're in for career wise, like, we could still do things to help people. And we just got to pay more attention to like our needs and our mental health as well.
Totally. Yeah, we've talked a lot about all of our fears and the hardships of it, but I really believe that, and I've seen this in my client outcomes, particularly my young, queer, dysregulated teens, early to mid adults going into 30s. That is a population of people I know I really thrive with and have great outcomes with. And I believe as a person with borderline working with those clients, I'm doing really well because of maybe some of my own experiences and insight, but really because I went to DBT and did a DBT program, and that gave me the tools to be what I believe is a very good DBT clinician. And to have a lot of empathy, but also like helping clients reframe some of their hopelessness around their symptoms. For like, sure. I feel like I'm very good at that. And so it's important that we say we have very unique, beautiful attributes to bring to this work. And I think super amazing opportunities to be good, good, good supervisors, like clinical supervisors, support people in their hours. I really want to be a part of the next generation of social workers.
For sure. For sure. Yeah. Yeah. And DBT, like, it's amazing. I'm still in a group and I think I have the best treatment team right now, just kind of like to continue to stabilize just like day-to-day things and make sure I'm paying attention to my needs. And I could honestly say like my team right now is the best I've ever had.
What is one thing that you want people to know before we record for a part two someday?
Yeah, I would just say like borderline is not a death sentence. Recovery is possible and learning to cope and get through life in a successful manner is totally doable.
Hi, friends. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Bold, Beautiful Borderline podcast. Lori and I are so grateful that you're here with us on this journey, and we can't wait to dive into more topics in the future with you all about borderline and even have some more fun and exciting guests to join us on the podcast. If you really enjoyed this episode, we would love if you would rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen. We would also love to see you interact with us on social media and on our Patreon page. The links to that are included in the show notes, so check us out there. We would be incredibly honored to get to know you all as you get to know us and our recovery stories. We love you, and we'll see you next time.